Lecture 9, The Copyists Who Gave Us Scripture.
Now that we've looked at some of the more important writings of the New Testament, Gospels, Epistles, and the Apocalypse, we can take a step back and ask how these writings actually came down to us today. We need always to remember that in the ancient world, the production and dissemination of books was quite different from today. There were no printing presses, photocopy machines, or electronic transfers of information. For books to be distributed, they had to be reproduced, and they could be reproduced only by hand, one word, one letter at a time. Not only was this a slow and painstaking process that disallowed the mass production of books in the modern sense, but it was also a process prone to errors. My students sometimes have difficulty believing that anybody copying a book by hand will necessarily make mistakes, and so I simply tell them, copy the Gospel of Matthew by hand and then compare it to a printed copy, and you'll see you make mistakes, even when you're trying not to. Even if you're a professional who does this for a living, mistakes will be made. This means, though, that in the ancient world, when there was more than one copy of a book, there was no guarantee that the multiple copies would be alike in all their details. Odds were that they would, in fact, be different from one another. So it isn't like today when somebody writes a book and the book gets reproduced in thousands of copies and every copy is exactly alike. In the ancient world, when books were copied by hand, every version of the book, every copy of the book would be slightly different, and some copies would be wildly different. When it comes to the Bible, this means when one of the books was being read in one location, it might be very different from the same book being read in a different location. As it turns out, we don't have the original copies of any of the books of the New Testament. None of the letters of Paul, the Gospels, the Apocalypse, in fact, of any early Christian text. The originals no longer survive. We're not sure why the early Christians didn't preserve the originals. Possibly they didn't see that there would be a problem. Possibly the originals themselves were used so frequently that they simply were worn out. Eventually, though, for one reason or another, they disappeared. They either were worn out or thrown out, or they were destroyed. Since we don't have the originals of the New Testament, what do we have? We have copies. The vast majority of the copies were produced in centuries after the originals, from copies that were themselves also centuries removed from the originals, that had themselves been made from earlier copies. The copies that we have today range in date from about the 2nd century up through beyond the invention of printing. And so we have handwritten copies up through the 16th century. With the invention of printing by movable type, the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg, you might expect that books would no longer be copied by hand. But in fact, it didn't work that way, just as since with the invention of the computer, people still sometimes use typewriters or, on those rare occasions, actually write something out by hand. The invention of the computer hasn't removed handwritten writing, for example, of letters in our age, just as the invention of the printing press didn't remove the production of manuscripts in its age. And so we have handwritten copies of books of the New Testament from after the invention of the printing press into the 16th century, and they go back as far as the 2nd century, but not very far back into the 2nd century. Remember, the books of the New Testament themselves were produced by and large in the 1st century. The earliest copies we have of the books of the New Testament are copies that are made on papyrus, which was an ancient writing material which was made out of the papyrus reed, which grew along the banks of the Nile River. There was a manufacturing process by which they could create a writing material out of papyrus. And it was, in fact, a fairly sophisticated process, and papyrus made for a very good writing material. Our earliest manuscripts, the manuscripts from the 2nd and the 3rd centuries up into the 4th century and somewhat beyond in some instances, are written on papyrus. Our very earliest manuscript of any book of the New Testament is in fact a little fragment that was discovered in a trash heap in Egypt. The fragment is the size of a credit card, and it has writing on both the front and the back of parts of verses from John chapter 18. It's significant that this papyrus fragment has writing on the front and back, because that shows that originally this copy of the Gospel of John was written in a codex, or in book form, rather than on a scroll. As you may know, in the ancient world, most literary texts were written on scrolls, but the early Christians, for some reason, preferred to write their documents, their books, in codex form, where you write on front and back of sheets and then stitch the sheets together into what is now the form of our books. This, our earliest fragment of the Gospel of John, was written in book form, codex form, rather than on a scroll. It's difficult to date ancient papyri manuscripts, but and the way they're typically dated actually is by handwriting analysis. The fancy term for that is paleography, the study of ancient writing. On paleographical grounds, this particular papyrus can be dated to the first part of the 2nd century, and so roughly maybe around the year 125 or the year 140. This papyrus is called P52 because it's the 52nd papyrus that has been cataloged by scholars who catalog such things. After the use of papyrus, starting in the 4th century, scribes copied their documents onto parchment manuscripts. Parchment is a writing material made out of animal skins, which was widely used until the widespread use of paper in early modern times. So we have copies of the New Testament, but we don't have the originals. The earliest copy is simply of a few verses from the early 2nd century. We don't have complete books on any manuscript that survives until about the end of the 3rd century, and we don't in fact have complete copies of the whole New Testament until the 4th century, 300 years after the books themselves were written. We have thousands of copies that survive. Most of the copies that survive, however, are from the Middle Ages. New copies show up on occasion. At present, we have over 5,400 copies in Greek of the Greek New Testament. Over 5,400 copies. But the vast majority of these copies are from the Middle Ages, hundreds and hundreds of years after the originals. Sometimes you'll hear a Christian apologist argue that the New Testament can be trusted because we have more manuscripts of the New Testament than of any other book from the ancient world. And part of that is true. We do have more manuscripts of the New Testament than of any other book from the ancient world. That doesn't mean that the writings of the New Testament can be trusted. All that means is that we are better positioned to know what the words of the New Testament originally were than we are for most other books. That doesn't mean that the words are true. I mean, they may be true or they may not be true. We simply can know what they are in most instances. But in fact, in many instances, it's difficult to know what the words are. The reason it's difficult to know what the words are, what the original words written by the authors are, is because of the differences found among these surviving copies. How many differences are there among these copies? Well, it's a striking phenomenon that among these 5,400 or so copies of the New Testament that we have, no two are exactly alike in all their wording. There are differences among all of these surviving copies, which means probably that all of them embody mistakes. And so one task of scholars is to try to reconstruct what the original author said, given the fact that we don't have the originals and we don't have copies that embody the text of the originals. Scribes who copied the Christian texts, including those of the New Testament, obviously changed their texts. This leads to a host of interesting questions that we'll be addressing in this lecture. Why were the originals of the New Testament changed in copying? How extensive are the changes? And if all of them have mistakes, if all the copies have mistakes, are there places where we don't know what the authors originally wrote? The fact that the originals don't survive and that we have mistaken copies was occasionally noted in the Middle Ages. But it wasn't until relatively modern times that this was recognized as a major problem that had to be dealt with. Occasionally, you'll have some Christian author, even in the ancient world, will say, well, different manuscripts have different wordings for this verse. But nobody really recognized the extent of the problem until modern times. Sometimes scribes themselves recognized the problem. There's a famous manuscript called Codex Vaticanus. It's called that because it was found in the Vatican Library. It's a very extensive manuscript of the New Testament. That's a high quality manuscript from the 4th century. And there's this interesting phenomenon in Codex Vaticanus. In the book of Hebrews, there's a passage which says, in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, the passage says, Christ manifests all things by the word of his power. But the scribe of Codex Vaticanus actually wrote, that's what the scribe wrote. He wrote, Christ manifests all things by the word of his power. The problem is that other manuscripts at that place read something slightly different. They say, Christ bears all things by the word of his power. It's a word that looks similar in Greek. The word is pharaon instead of the word phaneron. So Vaticanus' scribe wrote, Christ manifests all things, but other manuscripts say Christ bears all things. A scribe came along after Vaticanus was done and was reading through Codex Vaticanus and saw that he had a different word at this place. The scribe erased the word manifest and put in the word bears, similar sounding word. A few centuries later, another scribe came along and saw what the previous scribal corrector had done, and he erased the word bears and wrote back the word manifests, and then wrote a marginal note in the column, between the columns, the margin between the columns. And his marginal note says, fool and knave, leave the old reading. Don't change it. I think this is a wonderful instance of how scribes are changing their manuscripts and how some scribes got perturbed by it. I actually have a copy of this page framed sitting on my desk, above my desk in my study, because I think it's such a wonderful illustration of scribal changes of the text. Scholars didn't recognize how extensively the manuscripts of the New Testament were different from one another until the early 18th century. The major breakthrough came in the year 1707 with a publication of an edition of the Greek New Testament by an Oxford scholar named John Mill, who's, I think, unrelated to the later Victorian scholar John Stuart Mill. John Mill, in the early 18th century, he had actually spent 30 years of his life, comparing the Greek manuscripts that were available to him. He also looked at the ancient translations of the New Testament into other languages, Latin and Syriac and Coptic, ancient versions of the New Testament, to see what their texts said at different places. And he looked at how the New Testament was quoted by church fathers to see what their manuscripts must have looked like in their own day. Mill compiled the results of his collations of these manuscripts, and he published an edition of the New Testament in 1707 that included an apparatus of variant readings that he had discovered. In other words, he printed the text, and then underneath the text, he indicated places where he had found differences among the manuscripts. He only included the differences that he found to be significant. He didn't include everything that he found, only the differences in the manuscripts that he considered to be significant. To the shock and dismay of many of his contemporaries, Mill's apparatus indicated 30,000 places of variation among the manuscripts of the New Testament. 30,000 places where the manuscripts that he had examined differed from one another in their wording of the text. Remember, these are only the places that he thought were significant. A number of Mill's readers were outraged by the publication of this apparatus, and some of the more pious claimed that Mill was working to render the text of Scripture uncertain. Mill's defenders pointed out that Mill hadn't invented these places of variation. He had simply noticed that they existed, so he really couldn't be blamed for doing anything wrong. But 30,000 places of variation, that sounds fairly significant. And yet, scholars since the early 18th century have discovered many, many more variant readings among our surviving manuscripts, as manuscripts continue to be discovered even down till today. Today, people are still discovering manuscripts. Mill had examined about 100 manuscripts of the New Testament. Today, we have well over 5,000. We have 50 times more manuscripts than he had. So how many variant readings do we know about? How many places of variation survive to our knowledge? Well, the reality is no one knows how many variant readings there are among the manuscripts of the New Testament, because nobody has yet been able to count them all. Even with computers at this point, we still don't know. Some people put the number at 200,000, some say 300,000. I'm not sure how many there are, but perhaps it's easiest to put the number in comparative terms. There are more variants in our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. It's a lot of variation. Now, I should say that most of these variations are completely insignificant and of no bearing on anything. The majority of these simply show that scribes in antiquity could spell no better than most people can today. And, of course, this was in the world before there was spell check. There weren't even dictionaries. So, of course, scribes can't really be blamed for that. But a lot of the differences are simply blunders in spelling. And every blunder in spelling is a variant reading. There are lots of other accidental changes that one finds in manuscripts where scribes simply messed up. They were tired. They were inept. They were inattentive. Or for whatever reason, they simply made mistakes. Not just spelling differences, but differences such as change of word order, where they leave out a word and then stick it in later. Sometimes they'll accidentally leave out a word. Sometimes a scribe will accidentally leave out a line. If you have two lines of the text that end with the same words, for example, in Jesus' parable, he'll say something about the angels of heaven. Then a little bit later, he'll say the angels of heaven. And if both angels of heaven occur at the end of a line, then a scribe sometimes would copy the first angels of heaven, but then when his eye went back to the page, it would alight on the second occurrence of angels in heaven, and he'd start copying from there, and thereby he would leave out the intervening line. That is when lines end the same way, that's the technical term for that is homoeotelutaon. Meaning they end in the same way, homoeotelutaon. And when a scribe has an eye skip, where his eye skips to the wrong place, it's called parablepsis. And so this kind of mistake is called parablepsis occasioned by homoeotelutaon, as I tried to teach my students to recite. So there are lots of accidental changes. Sometimes scribes will leave out an entire page. Probably the most bizarre set of accidental changes in a manuscript is in a 14th century manuscript that is called Manuscript 109. The scribe of Manuscript 109 really blew it at one point in his manuscript, specifically in the place in Luke's gospel where Luke is giving the genealogy of Jesus. If you remember, in Luke's genealogy, Luke traces Jesus' line back through Joseph and who begot so-and-so, begot so-and-so, begot so-and-so, begot so-and-so, traces it all the way back to Adam, who's then said to be the son of God. So it's Jesus, supposedly the son of Joseph, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, back to Adam, who's the son of God. Well, the scribe of Manuscript 109 apparently was copying a manuscript in which the genealogy was given in two columns. So we had one column on the left, and then the second column on the right, continuing the genealogy. But the column on the right didn't go to the bottom of the page. This scribe, not paying attention to what he was doing, instead of copying the first column and then the second column, copied across the columns. So that he copied the first line of the first column, then the first line of the second column, second line of the first column, second line of the second column, and so forth down the line, which led to some very interesting results, including that since it didn't, the second column didn't go to the bottom of the page, the second column ends by saying that son of Adam, who is the son of God. Well, in this manuscript, it turns out that God is the son of Aram, and the father of the entire human race isn't Adam, it's a man named Pharez. So this scribe wasn't paying attention. So, well, there are lots of accidental mistakes in our manuscripts. In most instances, like this particular one of manuscript 109, it's fairly simple to detect what the problem is. Sometimes, though, it's difficult to know what the problem is. And this is especially the case in places where it looks like a scribe did not accidentally make a mistake, but where a scribe intentionally changed the text. There are passages that look like scribes have intentionally modified the texts that they were copying. Let me give you some of the more important textual variations that are quite significant for interpreting the New Testament, where it really matters what the original text was, because you have different forms of the text, and depending on which form of the text you have, the text reads very differently. Possibly the most famous is the story, well-known story, in John chapter 8 of Jesus and the adulteress. This is this could well be the best-known event in the life of Jesus. It certainly makes it into every Jesus movie ever made. Even Mel Gibson's Passion, which is about Jesus' last hours, includes one of the backflashes is about the potential stoning of the adulteress. You know the story. Jesus is teaching in the temple, and the scribes and Pharisees bring a woman to him. They say to him, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. According to the law of Moses, she's to be stoned to death. What do you say? Jesus kneels down on the ground and starts writing in the dirt. And then they keep questioning him. He looks up and he says, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. Then he continues writing, and they eventually start leaving, apparently because they realize their own guilt. They leave one by one, and Jesus looks up. There's nobody there except for the woman. He looks up and says to the woman, is there no one left to condemn you? And she says, no, Lord, no one. He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Well, it's a very interesting story. It shows Jesus' kind of cleverness at getting out of a trap, because he can't very well say, don't stone her, because then he'd be saying, don't follow the law of Moses, which he can't say. On the other hand, he can't say stone her, because then that violates his teachings of mercy and forgiveness. And so he's kind of stuck in this situation. They've trapped him, but he figures a way out of the trap. Very clever story. There are odd features of this story. For one thing, if this woman is caught in the act of adultery, where's the man? The law says you're supposed to stone both of them to death. Well, it's got some odd characteristics in it. What's most odd, though, is that the story was not originally found in the Gospel of John. It now occurs in John chapter 8. But in fact, in the oldest manuscripts of the Gospel of John, the story does not occur at all. Moreover, in some manuscripts, the story occurs in the Gospel of Luke. In a number of manuscripts, the story occurs, but it occurs with a kind of an asterisk, indicating that the scribe doesn't think that it's original. And when you read the story in Greek, the writing style is completely different from the writing style of the intervening of the rest of the Gospel of John. It's a different writing style. And when you take the story out of the Gospel of John and you read from where it begins to where it ends and just leave it out, the flow of the story of John makes perfect sense, much better sense than it does with the story in it. What's going on here? Apparently, some scribe knew of this story, had heard the story, and decided to write it out in the margin of a manuscript. And some later scribe saw this marginal note and thought it belonged in the text, and so stuck it in the text. Later scribes then copied that manuscript. The oldest manuscripts don't have the story, But the manuscripts used by the King James Bible translators, those manuscripts did have the story. That's why it came into the English language, because the King James translator were using late manuscripts that were not our best manuscripts, and so they reproduced the story, even though it was not originally found in the Gospel of John. This is not actually a story that was found in the original canon of the New Testament. A second example. Gospel of Mark has a very interesting ending. Jesus has been crucified and buried. On the third day, the women go to the tomb, but they find the tomb empty. They see a man there in the tomb, and the man tells them to go tell the disciples that Jesus will go before them to Galilee. They're to meet him there. So Jesus has been raised. They're to meet him in Galilee. Then Mark chapter 16, verse 8 says, "But the women fled the tomb and didn't say anything to anyone, for they were afraid." That's where the gospel ends in the oldest and best manuscripts. The women don't tell anybody, and Jesus never appears to the disciples. Boom, end of story. Which is a fascinating ending. It's a brilliant ending for the Gospel of Mark, where nobody can figure out who Jesus is, and at the end, they still don't figure out who he is, because they're not told that he's been raised from the dead. Terrific ending. Some scribes, though, were really taken up short when they got to that ending and thought, wait a second, Jesus surely appeared to people. Surely there were resurrection appearances. And so, a number of scribes added endings to the Gospel of Mark, including the ending that's found in most of our English Bibles. Like the story of the woman taken in adultery, in most modern English Bibles, you'll find that this ending is put in brackets. So the translator is telling you this is not an original ending, but is an ending that's been added on. In the added-on ending, there are 12 verses in which Jesus appears to his disciples. And in these verses, he tells them to go make disciples of all the nations. And he says that anybody who believes in my name will drink deadly poison, and they'll take up deadly snakes, and they won't hurt them. This is the passage that Appalachian snake handlers use to justify their handling of poisonous snakes. The problem is, it wasn't originally in the Gospel of Mark. This is a later scribal addition. No wonder some of these people end up in the hospital. It's not part of the Bible. This is a later addition. The Gospel of Mark originally ended with the women fleeing the tomb because they were afraid. In the Gospel of Luke, we saw that when Jesus is being nailed to the cross, he prays to God, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." There's an interesting variant at this point. In some of our best manuscripts, Jesus doesn't pray this prayer, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Why would a scribe change the text? Why would a scribe take out that prayer? It's interesting that in the early church, this prayer was interpreted as a prayer for God to forgive the Jews for their guilt in turning Jesus over to be executed. Well, if that's how it's interpreted, it's not surprising that scribes took it out. Scribes in an age that had grown increasingly anti-Jewish didn't want Jesus to pray for the forgiveness of the Jews, since God obviously hadn't forgiven the Jews, and so they took out Jesus' prayer for the Jews. Or a final example. In Mark chapter 1, Jesus is approached by a leper in order to be healed, and it says that Jesus felt compassion on him and healed him. But in some manuscripts, it says that Jesus got angry and healed him. Jesus got angry? Many scholars think that's the original text, and their logic is, if a scribe is copying that text, are they likely to change the text from saying Jesus felt compassion for the man to make him say he got angry, or are they more likely to take a text that said he got angry and change it to say Jesus felt compassion? Well, the latter is more likely. Therefore, that's likely the way the scribal change went, which means originally the text probably said that Jesus felt compassion, Jesus felt anger, and then healed the man, and scribes changed it to say that Jesus felt compassion. How do scholars make the decisions, though, about which text is original? Well, scholars use a number of criteria. They look at which manuscripts are the oldest manuscripts that survive. They look to see which readings are found in a wide range of manuscripts, found in a number of geographical locations. They look at which reading conforms most closely to the vocabulary and theology of the author. They see which reading it's likely a scribe created. Is it likely the scribe made Jesus angry or that the scribe made Jesus compassionate? The reading that's more difficult is the one that the scribe probably did not invent. The more difficult reading is probably the original reading in most cases. Using these and other criteria, scholars are confident that in most cases, we can be reasonably sure what the authors of the New Testament originally wrote, but there will always be places where we're not sure. It's important to remember that when we read the New Testament, we're not reading the originals produced by the ancient authors. We're reading translations into English of Greek texts whose originals don't survive. These translations are based on copies of the originals, and all of these copies have errors in them. In some places, we may not even know what an author originally said.